Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I want to introduce our special guest for this edition and welcome him to the session, Danny Clayman, VP and Managing Director, Northern Europe, Xander. Hi, Danny.
Hello, Rachel. How are you?
Not too bad. And I'm sorry to hear that we can't quite say the same for you, but thank you very much for battling on through and joining us anyway.
That's funny. Yeah, I've been a bit under the weather, but one of the upsides, I think, is I get this sort of husky voice, so hopefully that's an upside
for radio.
For yeah, exactly. I'm enjoying it, so I'm going to be sad to see that go.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's a way that you could probably hold on to that, but it's probably not to be recommended from a public health point of view. I'm thinking smoke a packet of fags a day. That's
I know. I know. Well, who knows?
Desperate times.
Yeah.
And of course, joining us from the Walthamstow Studios, Lindsay Rowntree, Head of Content with ExchangeWire. How are you doing there, Lindsay?
I'm good. No husky voice here.
No, but we've suddenly got a little bit of internet shenanigans going on. Say something else for us again.
Have we? What's happened to my internet?
Oh, no, that's better. Yeah, you were a little bit shaky for a minute.
Oh dear, maybe that's just me being shaky.
Shaky times. Okay, whilst I've got pictures of you not stilted and looking like they're about to fall apart, let's crack on with the podcast for fear of any other technical issues. So the first story I wanted to chat with you guys about this morning was an excellent piece written by Lara O'Reilly of DigiDay, released late last week, where she gives an in-depth picture on what 10 brands that she outlines are doing to deal with advertising and marketing during, you know, times of COVID. So this is a topic for conversation that we've talked about a little bit on the podcast for the last couple of weeks, but we haven't had something quite as detailed as this piece to use as fuel for our discussions. So Lara focuses on, like I said, 10 brands. I'll just give you a quick rundown because they're interesting brands: P&G, Unilever, Volkswagen, McDonald's, GSK, Coke, L'Oreal, NBC, Universal, Amazon, and then the automotive alliance between Renault, Nissan and Mitsubishi. And you get from reading this a real picture of the vast breadth of how brands and advertisers are coping with the crisis and what their strategy is for dealing with their businesses at the moment and how they're looking to organise themselves going forward. There's a lot to talk about in there, but I want to hear your perspectives on this first and foremost. And I guess what you could say is that it's sort of the findings are kind of summarised into those that have got money that can spend right now and are in a position to spend right now, those who need to take a bit of time to perhaps reset and refocus and think about how they're going to prepare themselves for when things bounce back, and then those that are using the opportunity to really focus on their kind of customer positioning and their customer orientation. What can they be doing to make their sort of proposition as helpful as possible to customers either now or, you know, as things start to return to normal? I'm using air quotes for that because who knows what normal is going to look like. And of course, there's lots of talk about how it's been an opportunity for innovation and what technology tools people have been using to try to get on top of that. I'm going to head to you first, Danny. What was your perspective on this really interesting piece?
I think it was a great piece, actually, and they've managed to pick out, you know, the top advertisers really across the world. And each one of those comes with different business models and different buying habits. And I think that's key to this is, you know, there's predominantly D2C brands in here, which you would expect, but whether or not they're B2B or D2C, each will have their own challenges in this situation. I think also whether they're predominantly looking at branding or direct response type activity is going to make a big difference here, as well as channel dependency. You know, there's certain channels that are in the space that, like out of home and cinema, I'd imagine would be struggling at this point, and these marketers are probably just thinking about reallocation of media budgets in some cases. I think there's some really interesting points made in here around the supply chain of the marketer, and that this is potentially a supply crisis, not a demand crisis that they're going through. And I think that was called out by the CEO of L'Oreal, and even some of the largest companies that are in here, like Amazon, who are posting upsides in revenue, are seeing drops in profits, where distribution for them is even becoming a bit of a challenge. So I think it was a really interesting report just to understand what are the challenges of these companies from both distribution and manufacturing, which can differ at a market level, and how they're tackling that. But I think All of them are consistent in wanting to ensure that, you know, marketing is front and center. That just the question is just, what is the point at which they can do that and how do they deliver it?
Yeah, that, and that's really an interesting point that you raise as well, that, you know, many of them talk about it being an issue of supply rather than demand. And, you know, it's also worth noting that there are advertisers in that list that have decided to pull all of their marketing spend altogether at the moment. So Coca-Cola is the example of that. And it really begs the question, you know, how sophisticated, I suppose, are some of these companies' approaches to marketing? And I think I was reading some interaction around this piece on LinkedIn a couple of days ago, and I think somebody said that the other element to this is the degree to which some of these companies see marketing as, you know, a sort of a cost or an investment, and therefore how do they organise themselves appropriate to that. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And Danny raised some interesting points about the performance advertising, the direct response advertising aspect versus the brand advertising aspect. And we've talked on previous week's podcast as well about it's the brands that remain the most visible that, you know, could be the ones that will have it may increase brand visibility when all this kind of starts to calm down and things start to come back to normal again. But I think as well, you'd be a bit foolish to be putting direct response budget out there at the moment if you don't have any demand. So it makes sense to push that budget that you do allocate for direct response into the branding side of things to try and maintain visibility. And we are seeing lots of brands do that in the UK as well. They're doing it a lot on TV, and they're doing it a lot in digital channels as well. And that does make a lot of sense. I'm interested in the list of companies here. Many of them would be classed as manufacturers that rely on retailers to be able to deliver to supply their goods. And the challenge they'll have there is it's not just down to them and the demand for their own products. It's down to whether the companies they work with, the retailers they work with, are struggling as well. And a lot of these in the UK, for example, you know, might be big department stores. You think of things like John Lewis, House of Fraser, Debenhams, that they've had to close all their stores. They're trying to ramp up demand online, but might be struggling with that. And a lot of these big manufacturers that work with those kinds of brands are going to struggle with that as well, because they're not relying on their own resources here. They're having to rely on resources of third parties, which could make them think, well, actually, maybe a lot of these brands have been looking at digital transformation for a long time anyway, and looking at maybe we can start to own that direct customer relationship more. Maybe this is the kick they need to try and build that and grow that. You know, P&G, for example, could they start selling toilet roll online and sell like annual supply of toilet roll to people for a cheaper price than what they might buy in Sainsbury's, a bit like Amazon does something similar already with certain manufacturers. Could the likes of P&G go and do that? And I'm interested as well because L'Oreal saying that the makeup, there's been a decline in makeup but a rise in skincare, and actually, you know, there are many women now that they aren't leaving their house, they're not wearing makeup, but they are thinking, I must take better care of my skin. I'm going to buy moisturising cream instead and try and use this time at home to make myself look better. So it's how brands are understanding how people are reacting during lockdown and how consumer behaviour is evolving that will come out the other side of that. So if L'Oreal understand that and will go start promoting skincare more, understand more about what consumers are looking for and not promote, you know, as they said, lipstick doesn't do very well with face masks. That don't promote lipstick, but shift that budget into skincare instead. It's how they're allocating their budgets, not just in direct response versus branding, but also on a product by product basis, and understand the consumer behaviour that could see them have good big opportunities here.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, you know, I guess that also says something about the degree to which, you know, various brands, not just these named brands, because like you say, Lindsay, a lot of them are very large brands, have got a manufacturing base, so we can assume that they've actually got a lot of tools and technology at their fingertips to try to deal with this. But in general, it says something interesting about the degree to which brands can use as much customer data as possible to understand exactly what the customers are doing right now. And the other thing that's interesting about what you just said, because I think I had a conversation with somebody about this recently too, is the notion that some of these big CPG brands have actually had demand come directly to them. Somebody was telling me about a friend they've got that works at P&G that said that they had people contacting them directly, reaching out to them for the general public saying, can you sell us toilet paper directly? Which is just amazing, really.
I'm not surprised at all. I think especially if you think back in the UK a few weeks ago where you could not get toilet roll for love nor money, and you would have at the time probably have paid a pretty penny for it if you were that desperate. I can understand why people would be going to P&G directly. Particularly in Europe, we had massive stock panic buying overload it makes a lot of sense.
Danny, how's your stock of loo roll over there?
Pretty good. We got in early, but we didn't go overboard. So, yeah, we haven't had to adapt too much.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Have you got some thoughts, Danny, on the kind of customer data side of things and the sort of suite of technology tools that brands might be using in times like this to kind of better understand either the ways that they can be as useful as possible to their own customers, but also the ways that they can reorganize their businesses?
Yeah, I think at this stage, regardless of how big the business is, brand loyalty is likely to be pretty high. I can't see that many sort of offer-led transactions seeing that much scale in the market. But I think, you know, the more you know about your customers and the better that you can understand their behavior. And I think, Lindsay, you talked a lot there about consumer behavior. Now more than ever, it's important to understand how consumers are thinking about transactions, how they feel about engaging with advertising. And I think it's really important for us to be nimble and more agile in terms of how we approach both sort of marketing investments, but also just day-to-day interactions with our customers. I think a lot of the things that you'll see at the moment are around brands doing well because they have strong corporate social responsibility and ethics that progresses their business, because consumers are in a position where they're really seeking that in the brands that they're loyal to. So I think more of that will come. And like you said, you know, the technologies that are in place that allow brands to really understand econometrics and you know, where various channels are adding value versus not, I think that's probably been a little bit blown up over the past 2 months. So reevaluating some of those measures, better understanding what's happened for the past sort of 8 weeks, and then thinking about customer loyalty sort of front and center in terms of what they're doing as opposed to new acquisitions of new customers is probably the way to go.
Yeah. And I wonder about that sort of timeline that you touch on there is quite interesting as well, because, you know, this is we've all been through an incredible journey over the last sort of 6 to 7 weeks. And in the early days of lockdown, we were hearing, you know, so much about brands that were just terrified of advertising at all because there was no content out there that wasn't related to something, you know, overwhelmingly negative. And that sentiment has to have changed over time. I mean, certainly, you know, in this article, we're hearing about brands that are feeling, to some extent, you know, some of them are reporting feeling very confident about advertising at the moment. But also that has to have changed as people have kind of adjusted to the environment that we're in and realised that actually it's not so much that the only content out there is negative, it's that it's the only content out there. This is what's going on in our lives at the moment. There's no reason necessarily for brands who are in a position to be getting messaging out there to completely back away from that.
Yeah, I think the piece that most of the brands that we're speaking to are just trying to focus on brand voice, you know, putting the consumer first, aligning your brand message with the context of where we are in today's environment is important. I don't think any of these tactics are anything new. We've been doing it for years. You know, audience-based messaging is nothing new at all. But it's the importance of this messaging that really conveys a brand's sort of message in terms of what they're trying to do as a company and a business, as opposed to looking at direct and immediate sales. And I think that will be what creates that sort of longer lasting customer loyalty that they all seek.
Yeah. 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 Okay. I'm going to be jumping over to the publishing side of the world of advertising. This is a story from Axios that was penned late last week, talking about how there's a number of Western governments that are receiving a great deal of pressure to focus on mechanisms they can put in place to help support and save local news outlets. And of course, that's directly related to severe decline in advertising revenues that these businesses are experiencing as a result of global lockdown. So what I thought was interesting is firstly, the article was just looking very briefly at you know, some major Western economies, so the UK, the US, Canada, Australia and Ireland. And it was really interesting to see the breadth of approaches that have been taken. So, you know, it was pretty much everything from sort of taxation credits and small business relief funds and, you know, government-backed financial opportunities to proactively encouraging the government to spend more in advertising campaigns to try to boost that advertising revenue and, you know, provide some sort of movement in that in the kind of advertising supply chain. And then going towards the other end, in Ireland, there was the proposition of putting forward a big tech company tax and the proceeds of that actually being reinvested back into small businesses and small publishing businesses being some of those that could benefit from that. So the Australian government, having had a sort of an ambition for a long time to try to force Google and Facebook to take some responsibility for the ways in which they distribute news that they use, and specifically wanting to put forward, a mechanism that forces them to pay for access to that news. So it's a huge range of measures. A really interesting time, I think, for this to be being brought forward, because we've been talking about the need for publishers to diversify their revenue models for a long time, but this is a series of measures that are being proposed in a moment of crisis. So interested in your views, and specifically I'd like to know what you think about where publishers' minds are at the moment in terms of the diversification of their revenue models. There's got to be some publishers out there that have worked really hard to diversify their revenue models that might feel like, thank God we did that, because now we've at least got something else that we can be using to try to drive revenue. But is that applicable in the context of small and local news outlets, which, you know, traditionally really rely on classifieds and advertising revenue? Is that even possible? Danny, what's your point of view?
I think the so if we sort of separate the current situation with sort of keyword blocking and everything else that's a separate challenge in terms of revenue streams for publishers, I think the most progressive publishers in the space will, pardon me, net out better from this, where they've started to invest in new ways of allowing their consumers or users to engage with their content. So that could be via podcasts, it could be streaming, it could be various ways of me being able to consume the same news just under the environment that I want. So in that way, I think those diversification in revenue streams has been quite progressive, especially in the UK with a lot of those traditional news brands potentially. Again, to your point, the smaller publishers may struggle a little bit there, but I think there's more autonomy than ever in order to innovate in this area. And I think there's a lot of the sell side platforms, including Xandr, that are able to support. The primary factor right now really is around, you know, the general population is consuming more news than ever before online. And we're in a situation where this is a sort of highly engaged audience. It's one that's performed well, regardless of whether you're in that direct response or branding effort from the buy side for a long time, but it's not being monetized. And, you know, the options for consumers are you to user generated content or you go to, you know, high quality journalism. And that's the section that's not being monetized today because of the sort of keyword block lists that are being put in place. And I think there's various industry initiatives that are great that are getting behind this. You've seen the Back Don't Block campaign. There's some of the work that the IAB kicked off at the start of this year in order to think about the buying models that you put in place and your keyword blocking. This is via their content verification guide. So this has actually been a problem for a long time. It's just been amplified by the situation we're in now. And I think there is some solutions that we can bring to market to get around this. So it's a challenging situation. I don't think it's one that can be overcome. And like I said, I think there's solutions in market that can get there today.
Yeah. Lindsay, what's your feeling about the world, the publishing world in general, specifically small local news publishers, especially considering that some of these initiatives, I'm thinking more ones around tax credits and small business loans are temporary, right?
Yeah, I think that, we know from what our own government's doing in the UK that what they're doing to help these kinds of small businesses will only last for a couple of months. And at the end of that, they have to just, you know, bounce back to normal, and that's not going to happen. So what are the other alternatives? And it's encouraging to see that, you know, in many senses, it's the government actually backing these publishers themselves by actually running their own advertising campaigns, like the COI in the UK, putting a lot of money behind NHS targeted, NHS relevant advertising. And we're seeing other governments in the Western economies do similar things. And hopefully they will be able to continue to do that, because they do, they are some of the largest advertising budgets in most countries. So they do have the budget to be able to continue that. And hopefully they will do so to, I guess, mitigate the loss that, that publishers, you know, this isn't just digital news publishers, but online broadcasters as well are suffering at the moment. But I think Danny made a good point about the fact that we're trying, you know, this is not really new. We've been talking about publisher diversification in terms of revenue diversification for a long time now. Think about the amount of times we bring it up on stage at ATS events. Like, so it's a similar thing to what we were talking about earlier with the big brands and how they're advertising. Actually, this is forcing people to do things more quickly than they would have done. It's one of those things that gets put to the back seat because everything else has to take priority, because everyone has to kind of just go through their, like, each passing day. But actually now everyone's hands are being forced to doing new and different things. And this will mean that hopefully out the other side of this, whatever that may look like, there will be new and interesting ways that publishers have found that will enable them to look at new ways of getting revenue, which doesn't just rely on, you know, traditional, like, banner advertising, or looking at the way that they're targeting people and the way that they're, you know, as Danny mentioned, user-generated content could play a big role in this. And I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff that a lot of the smaller publishers can do that aren't necessarily news publishers, that should still be, in many regards, getting a fair amount of traffic during this, depending on what kind of content they're covering. You know, if you happen to have a baking blog or a kind of, I don't know, we're talking about L'Oreal, kind of a beauty regime blog or those kinds of things at the moment, that kind of content, you might be doing really well out of this, because there's a lot of traffic at the moment with people wanting to learn new hobbies or understand how they can change their routines. And there's opportunity there for them to take what they're getting at the moment to maybe continue that. So there's the flip of it. There's the new side that's gone down for advertisers, but might will hopefully come up again. Then there's always traffic going to these kind of smaller publishers that might well go down again at the end of this, when everyone has to go back and lead a relatively normal life again. But how can they learn from what they're getting at the moment to try and continue that in terms of how they diversify their revenue going forwards? So I think there's lots of interesting nuances, and we talk mostly about news publishers and how they are struggling at the moment. But actually, there's so much more than that when it comes to what we refer to as publishing, and so many more ideas out there for what people could be doing. It's a random rant, but, you know.
But it was good. It was an enjoyable rant. I mean, yeah, that's, you know, you paint a picture of the sort of need to diversify content businesses, right? For publishers to think about their businesses not just as either news or providing information if they're not necessarily a news publisher, but maybe focused on another sort of specific vertical or topic. The idea is that actually it's about how they monetize their content business and what those content assets look like. Danny, do you get the impression that, you know, there's a lot of publishers out there that are perhaps a little more prepared to be creative in the way that they sort of put together their revenue models?
I think so. I mean, the topic of convergence is one that we've seen come up a lot over the past couple of years, and it's here. It's not as if it's going to be future state. It's here and now. I think we touched on consumer behavior a lot in the past, you know, couple of minutes, and I think the idea of a world where we are now and this existing as future state is difficult to imagine. But publishers are certainly, from what I can see, are certainly leaning into figuring out how does consumer behavior line up to what I have as my content model and how I work with my various partners in terms of thinking about new revenue streams. For smaller publishers, you look at some of the coalitions that are in market for the larger pubs, but the smaller, there's nothing stopping smaller pubs from getting involved in some of this and being more proactive in getting a footing in some of these more strategic alignments that you see in market. We certainly see it in markets outside of the UK, where, you know, there is a bigger fight against some of the platforms that where they believe this competitive nature of their relationship is not long term. So they've taken control themselves. I think that's one thing that one of the publishers locally and globally actually can think about, is now is the time to really take control of your decision making and start thinking about those revenue streams for the long term, not just what's happening right now.
There's never been a better time, basically. Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, I'm going to move us on to the third story of the week. So ISBA released a really interesting report this week called the Programmatic Supply Chain Transparency Study. And it's actually a map, if you like, of the entire supply chain from advertisers to publishers. They performed this study in conjunction with PwC and and, you know, fairly confidently state this is the first time that somebody's actually sat down and mapped that entire supply chain. Their findings were pretty interesting. Some of them perhaps not that surprising. They found a lot of complexity and, you know, sort of in general, a broad lack of organisation across the supply chain. The major findings focused on where advertisers' money was going. Statistics that they've published is that publishers receive 51% of advertiser spend on average. And then, of course, another proportion of spend goes to visible costs, such as DSP and SSP fees and other technology costs. But there's 15% of advertiser spend that just disappears into a black hole and couldn't be attributed anywhere. And that, of course, has started some very interesting conversations in the ad tech community. And so I'm really interested to hear what you guys think about it. The report's made a couple of recommendations that the standardisation of the industry is critical in order for, you know, for the industry to sort of mature to a more organised state of affairs, then it's something that's urgently required. The report states that refers to everything from contractual arrangements and technology arrangements right through to data sharing and how we sort of understand and I suppose organise ourselves as an industry around transparency. And the report also recommends that there needs to be more collaboration amongst the industry. That's perhaps not necessarily news to many of us that work in ad tech and martech. Really interesting report, goes into a lot more detail, but I wanted to hear your perspective on this because I'm imagining that this will inspire a lot of conversation. And Lindsay, I'm going to start with you. What was your take on this ISBA report?
I mean, firstly, I was surprised to see that the study shows that publishers receive 51% of advertiser spend on average, because the number that's been bandied about for years and years has been far less than that, sometimes as low as 10%. So them saying that publishers are getting half of it, you know, hopefully will make publishers, you know, feel a bit better about themselves.
Advertisers getting half of it. Did you say advertisers or publishers?
Publishers getting half of what advertisers are putting in.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, publishers might feel maybe less lambasted. I'm not sure publishers will necessarily agree with that figure, because they'll feel like, well, there's far more going into this kind of middle ground, the kind of the so-called ad tech tax, and they'll feel that they're getting a far less proportion than 51%. So that's an interesting number. Mm. And this 15% is interesting too, that this just disappears into the ether, although I would say hardly surprising. And maybe some people could think it actually is probably even more than 15%, where there's no idea where this money goes. There are so many partners involved in the middle. But the thing about this is, obviously, ISBA doing this, they've done this kind of from the viewpoint of the advertiser, and maybe that should have been done a long time ago, but it does call for this coming together of all the different trade industry associations to have this conversation from the supply side, the buy side, and everything in between. I just feel like it's a conversation that's been had so often, and we have seen improvements, but I don't necessarily, and there's been a lot that's been done ever since, you know, the IAB have released their version of a similar report, the AOP have done their version. Over the years, we've seen many different versions of what this looks like and what advertisers are putting in versus what publishers are getting out, and then what happens in the middle. This doesn't really, I don't know what this will change, but it obviously goes to reinforce that there is still a problem in the supply chain. There is still an issue of transparency. Like I said, the fact that ISBA are the ones putting this viewpoint out are going, you know, they're saying, you know, from our perspective and the perspective of the marketers that we work with, we want to highlight that we still see a problem with transparency and we're still having concerns about this. Maybe they feel it's not getting talked about enough, which is why they're trying to bring it to the fore again. And, you know, despite everything going on globally in the world at the moment, transparency is still an issue. And maybe this is an opportunity. Again, we've talked a lot about this in this podcast. Now is the time for reset across a number of different things. Maybe this is a chance, because we will see a consolidation and we will see a kind of a diminishing of companies that will make it through to the other side of this. And maybe there will be a natural streamlining of companies that exist in the middle across the entire supply chain within the ecosystem. Perhaps this will help drive that. But I feel like, I don't know, it's just another, we know that this is not really news, that some of the numbers in there are interesting and news and suspect, but this is not news to me, basically. But then, Danny, you are much more embedded in this. You might go, actually, this is very helpful for us because we've been needing this for a long time. So,
well, I think, yeah, we've been pushing this effort across the last God knows how long. We really commend the efforts of anybody that's trying to improve the ecosystem and the efficiency and trust that sits within it. So we're a part of the study with all of the other leading platforms in the market. And we stood on stage at the ISBAR Summit 2 years ago to actually talk about the need for fair trade and the ecosystem and more transparency through there, which we can obviously provide on our own platform because we have a buy and a sell side solution. But it's not always the case when you work with external platforms. There is natural discrepancies that you see between platforms that are well known and acknowledged in the market. So I think the bit that the report misses from my point of view, and by the way, the report is great that it's come to the forefront, but there's been a lot of collaboration in the industry to date. I've just found the quote from John Muir at IEB, who've been really progressive in this area, actually. So he said, "Programmatic advertising is complex, but it's not a dark art, and we shouldn't lose sight of the valuable role it plays in supporting our open ad-funded web." I think that's absolutely the case. Like, there is a high level of complexity here, and I think complexity is one of the things that we need to figure out as an ecosystem and an industry to try and move forward on. And we've seen some really progressive approaches in how this is done across the industry bodies. So not just with ISBAR, but IAB have been leading on this front, I would say, launching the gold standard, the transparency FAQs that they've brought to market to better educate the industry around this. There's various sort of initiatives in market like AdsTXT and the JIKWEDS approach. So, really the work that the IAB have pushed and done across this area, working with other industry bodies as well, is designed to move the industry forward. And I think that's what we're trying to do here. On the report itself, I think, everybody here, including ISBAR, have acknowledged that there's further work to be done. And that is required in order for us to reach an actionable conclusion. I think that's the goal of this, is to create progression and an active conclusion that we can actually move forward with as an industry. And there's still a step to be taken to get there. So, there's been a huge collective effort to put this report together. I think there's a second step to be taken. And we're happy to be central to that, and I think it'll happen pretty quickly.
So, just interestingly, Danny, were you surprised by any of those figures and stats?
Yeah. Mm. We obviously work with various platforms on buy and sell side in terms of the integrations that we have. I just don't think that from the report that came out, there's any real correlation from the data analysis that can be provided because of the depth of where the report went. Yeah. I think that extra depth is required in order for us to better understand how they got to that analysis. So I think there's various people that need increased, or various participants that need the adequate visibility in order to get there. Yeah. So like the model that was used, how the data was collected, and that differs by platforms that are involved. So, I think we haven't seen or observed any of the reporting discrepancies of the size that were communicated in the report. So I think there's certainly work to be done there. But again, these types of reports and the initiatives that are in place here, they need to be done. They're designed in order to push the industry forward. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Yeah. And were you also saying that, you feel like there is quite a high level of collaboration amongst industry bodies already? Certainly there's been a lot of collaboration, in order to even just get a report like this off the ground. And you mentioned all of the good work that the IAB are doing, that other industry bodies and associations are doing. What do you think is going to drive, either further collaboration or enough collaboration to actually, get to the bottom of all of this? Where are we going to see that push come from?
Yeah, I mean, we sort of board members of the IAB, for example, and we have industry leaders in that room on a monthly basis bi-weekly basis to talk about some of the areas that we're focused on across the group. I think that room and that level of discussion will just grow. And I think bringing more people into the fold and more bodies and regulatory bodies probably as well is important in order to make sure that there is a agreed way to get to the bottom of this reporting. I think that was one of the challenges, and that is always going to be the challenge with any of these reports, frankly, is that the methodology used is really important because each technology platform sets themselves up in a slightly different way. Technology platforms speak to each other differently, and therefore it's really hard to use a single methodology approach that provides sort of statistically relevant data. So I think that is a key piece of it, is just opening up the model that was used and the findings that came with it.
Yeah. And because some of the language, you know, even just in the very high level findings, reminded me a little bit of some of the ICO stuff that came out late last year, you know, this idea that the industry is shrouded in complexity, and that, you know, I suppose that there is a sort of an unknown about where some of the money in the supply chain goes. I know the ICO report was looking into practices specifically relating to RTB, but I just wonder how much of that has become a bit of a rhetoric that floats around about the industry, particularly the programmatic part of the industry. Like you say, you know, the IAB quite rightly come out and say, yes, okay, programmatic's complex, but it's not a dark art. And, you know, this needs to be something that we legitimately and openly discuss. And I would argue that the same could be said of all of the practices around programmatic and RTB, you know, that came out as a result of the ICO report last year. Is the more that we talk about this openly and the more that we interrogate the processes and have those conversations, surely the closer we'll get to better understanding exactly what's happening, to making sure that there's some transparency and consistency across the ecosystem.
I think ISBA run the risk of, when producing such things, obviously they've called for collaboration. And as Danny mentioned, there has been a lot of collaboration and will continue to be. But they run the risk of, if they come out with this kind of information saying this is from the perspective of the advertiser, the rest of the industry will look at the advertisers and think that the advertisers believe that the RTB system, like ecosystem we're running with at the moment, is entirely black box. And that's not the case, hasn't been the case for a long time. You know, John, you calling it it's not a dark art, but when they come out with these kinds of comments, they can almost put themselves into a box and then almost isolate themselves from the rest of the industry. And that is the danger that ISBA need to make sure they don't fall into, because they can alienate some other groups by saying, we believe this about the industry, or this is what we found about the industry. And that's what we can't have happen, because there are many advertisers out there that don't believe that are fully embedded in the process. They're very, very involved with that. They work with all their partners. They understand how it works. There are obviously advertisers, marketers out there that don't understand this, but it's wrong to kind of, they haven't said it, but it's wrong to insinuate that this is not transparent at all. And it's very much black box and we have no idea what you guys are doing.
Interesting. I mean, you know, where does everyone think the 15% unknown delta is going? Just out of interest.
Dodgy rebates.
You don't have to answer if you don't want, Danny.
I just think, you know, that there is further work to be done here to even acknowledge the 15% number and to reach that actionable conclusion. So before we dig into the 15%, that needs work from my perspective. These discrepancies, what you see, can come from various areas. So you look at impression counting methodologies across companies, they differ, user connectivity, hardware issues, like there's various ways that this can happen. I think, you know, platforms are working off different numbers. This is why I think we really need to understand the methodology better so that we can make better conclusions from this 15% mark. But you know, that visibility isn't there right now, and I think we'll get it. And I think ISBA will probably lean into making sure that that's the case. And, you know, we can then have a better assessment of this 15%. But I think there's acknowledgement across all of the participants that we want to get there. There's, you know, we wouldn't have entered into this study that we felt this was going to be a confidence boost for the market. And, you know, between the industry collaboration that we've seen, the platforms are speaking well to each other. It's not in our interest to have something like this happen. So I think that this next step will be the most important one.
Yeah. A lot of interesting things to come from here on. Okay, I'm going to move us into the second part of our podcast, where we spend a little bit more time focusing on what you've been working on of late over there at Xander, Danny. Some things perhaps that you're specifically focusing on now, some things perhaps that you're getting ready, you know, to sort of spend a bit more time involved in. As things sort of gradually unlock, I suppose could be a way of describing what we might be about to be confronting. So tell me a little bit about life at Xander right now.
Yeah, it's been an interesting time for us. I mean, we've adjusted pretty quickly to the new norm, if you like. I think the important thing for us is just trying to regularly reevaluate where we are and think about how we can better support our teams and our clients is at the forefront. There's two major pieces we've been focusing on, one for a long time. One is a newer sort of initiative that we've been partnering with a couple of companies on. So First one is around like just the transparency approach that we have. And I'll touch on this briefly because we've talked about it a lot. The past 2 years, we've been working with publishers to sign contracts that allow us to provide our tech fee on the sell side to the buy side. And that allows them to see 100% working media. So we've got that up to about 65, 66% of our UK supply. And so that really provides the insight that we've been talking about here to brands, where they're able to see exactly where their money's going to the point that it ends up with the publisher. We also avoid a lot of discrepancies that we're talking about there because we have 100% ID match with the platform on buy and sell side. And I think that's one of the benefits of having both sides that a lot of the competitors that we have in market might say is a conflict of interest, but we see as our biggest advantage, especially when these types of things come out. So that's one thing. The second one is around a partnership that we've launched with Mantis, so via Reach. So this is a product that's powered by IBM Watson and is getting around those challenges that we've talked about in the industry that relate to keyword blocking and measurements that have been put in place by buyers, where they're relying on a fairly straightforward approach to keyword blocking as opposed to thinking about this semantically, which is what Reach is doing. I think most companies in the space, by the way, that are in this measurement in this contextual space are sort of moving to that model. But the advantage with Mantis is that it's AI based, so it should improve as we get more scale. I think the challenges that we've seen are that there's a lot of positive content that we've seen around COVID and coronavirus over the past 2 months, I guess it is at this point. But they're just not being reached. And we're really relying on news brands to continue to invest in highly relevant, fact-based journalism. And that isn't being monetized. So Mantis can get around that by taking a more intricate approach to how we're looking at scanning pages. It means that you'll be able to serve on stories around sort of homeschooling, cooking tips, staying fit at home, Captain Tom, the list goes on. I think they're the types of things that brands are more than open to being in front of, as opposed to it being blocked and they're not getting the scale that they want. We think it's something like 70% of content could be opened up by doing this. So we've had some really great results in the initial testing and some new advertisers and agencies coming on board. So we expect that to grow, and we're hoping that it can get around some of the challenges that we're seeing in the ecosystem, especially with news publishers, that we need to make sure that they're in a good spot and that they're able to continue to provide us the information that we need. And I think, again, there's various studies in market that would tell you how much of that we're relying on at the moment. So like 70% of our engagement time is on those brands. So they're the two sort of major focus areas that we're putting more resources into at the moment.
For a second there, I was thinking, who's Captain Tom? But only for a second, because he's dead fast.
Yeah, and he's been promoted.
Yes, so he has. Yeah. He's had a great time, Captain Tom. And for anyone who is listening outside of the UK and doesn't know who Captain Tom is, Google him. He's a very important person. How long have you been sort of offering that as a product or tool? And because you were saying you're already working with some brands and agencies on it, or onboarding more agencies. So what are sort of some of the early results? And presumably this is good news for publishers as well.
Yeah, I mean the publishers. The Mantis solution was developed by Reach, so that's our main partnership there. So you can get the Mirror, the Express, Mail Online are involved, CNN. A host of other publishers that onboarding as we go through. So the initial results have been great. I think, again, as we push the product to market, we only literally launched it this week. So we've had various deals. So we would set up those curated deals of supply, and then buyers are able to target it very efficiently and effectively. And I think the results that we've seen have been overwhelmingly positive. It's just as we get more supply on board, there'll be more scale. We've got, I'll have to come back on the amount of scale that we have right now, but it's significant, and it's enough for news publishers to get involved and think about how they can scale in an environment where this keyword approach is not going to go away anytime soon. And I think that this solution provides something that isn't just a near term, it's just been amplified by the COVID and coronavirus keyword issue. This was something that we were actually thinking about long before, and is a sort of challenge that the industry's faced, and again, acknowledged by IAB for a long time. So it's just been amplified, and it's something that we can get moving on quickly. I'm hoping it provides the revenue upsides to brands and the reach and scale and audience targeting to publishers and the necessary approach to brands to get them what they need in terms of that audience, because it is there and it's rich.
In a way, you know, and I don't mean even remotely to sound glib about this, but in a way, this current set of circumstances is the sort of perfect environment in which to sort of test the capabilities of this, right? Because it might be a scenario that starts to get advertisers much more confident about how they, you know, arrange, you know, keyword block lists and what tools and technology they use to sort of circumnavigate that. And also it's an opportunity perhaps for publishers to think about the ways in which they're organizing their content and to get a little bit more, a little bit more bought into the notion of the way that they arrange the context of their content, because they know that perhaps there is a revenue uplift that they didn't see before.
Yeah. And I think they've probably started to do that a while ago, and the benefit of a solution like Mantis is that it has that semantic element to it. It also works in video. And I think there's a lot of progress that can be made just by relying on the platform itself. The nature of the AI element is going to allow publishers to actually not have to do that much. The pages and the content will be scored, and there will be positive sentiment or neutral sentiment associated with that content. And brands would either serve on that or they wouldn't. So, I think it's important for brands who are just looking at this area, who are probably reliant on existing solutions in place, just to think about testing it, see what comes out of it. No level of commitment required. It's just something that we believe could make major progress long after the challenges we're seeing with coronavirus and COVID. I think this is something that's here for the long term.
And that's a good point, actually, that this sort of current set of circumstances, which are fairly acute, will hopefully sort of, you know, be resolved sometime soon. But actually, we're going to be dealing with a different way of living for a very long time. And so that means that, you know, the way people move around, the way that people consume things, the way that people even consume content, the stuff that they buy, is going to be different for quite a long time. So it's a really interesting time to be running an AI type of tool on all of that activity, because it's going to be fascinating to see, you know, how that does build and scale over the coming sort of 6 to 12 months.
Yeah, and you know, IBM Watson that the Mantis has built has got a lot of heritage. It's a very trustworthy IBM solution. I think this keyword issue has been here for, you know, a long time, and it will extend to keywords outside of COVID and coronavirus long term. So I think it's, you know, whilst it's solving an immediate problem, it's a solution that's got longevity, and that I think we're certainly going to back and do more with over time.
Sounds very interesting. Okay, we've pretty much run out of time. Thank you very much, Danny, for joining us. Thank you for, you know, battling through your lurgy to be on the podcast with us. I must say you look very well.
You're welcome. So. Thank you for having me.
No, not at all. But I, you know, like I said, you look very well. I'm not worried about your health at all. Lindsay, thanks very much for joining us from the Walthamstow Studios.
You're welcome. And I just realised there's a word we haven't mentioned in the podcast today that we always mention. So I'll just say it a few times just so we get their quota up. Gaming. There we go. Sorted.
How did we miss that? Unbelievable. I thought it was going to be something much more nefarious, so I'm quite relieved it was gaming. Thanks very much, guys. And that was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.